There's a lot of things about life that I miss, pre-COVID-19 life that I miss these days. And I think something that I'm coming to realize I miss the most, probably the most out of everything with all the changes that we've all experienced in our lives in these past few months, is the opportunity to worship with my brothers and sisters. It's crazy how much my heart longs to gather together, hearing the voices, joining with the voices of my brothers and sisters, with you as we worship and sing songs of praise to our glorious God who saved us. You know, every week Matthew does such a great job filming and recording music for us to sing along with at home, and I do that at our house, right? I sit up in our living room and I sing, and it's just not the same. It feels kind of weird, even if Michelle is singing too. And our family, since we have young kids, we happen to watch the kids' church videos each week that Renee puts out for us. And those videos always have songs with action. So I even try to sing the songs and do the actions. And I do that until my family shuts me down every week. And they say, "Dad, you are so embarrassing. Please stop singing and dancing. It's just weird to be doing that at home." And maybe you miss gathering together as a community and worshiping as well. One day it'll happen. Why do I say all this? Well, worship. The text that we're going to be looking at today deals with worship. A definition that I like that's nice and short, Eugene Peterson came up with, and he defines worship as responding to the living God. Worship is responding to the living God. Worship, there's different forms of it, and it can include singing and dancing and playing an instrument and shouting and leaping and lying prostrate before God and offering sacrifices to God. These are all legitimate forms of worship if they are in response to the living God. I'm going to take a play out of Pastor Brian's playbook today, and since we're trying to cover a whole chapter, we're not going to have time to read the whole thing together out loud, so I want to ask you if you could grab a Bible at home, wherever you are, whether you're alone or with family, open it up to 2 Samuel chapter 6, and I'd love for you to pause this recording and read it out loud. If you're on your own, you read the whole thing. If you're together with a group, why don't you take turns reading through sections? Pause the video, read it out loud so that you can become familiar with it, and then start up the recording again, and we'll continue with the rest of the message. So please pause the video now and read 2 Samuel chapter 6. Now, I don't know if you actually read it or not, if you followed the instructions. Some of you probably did, some of you didn't, so I'm going to have to give you a recap. In case you didn't, for those of you who did not follow the instructions, here's what you just read in 2 Samuel 6, or perhaps you read it and you didn't understand it. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, King David has become the king of Judah and the king of Israel. The kingdom has come together. Both kingdoms have become one, and David's decided to make the capital city of his kingdom Jerusalem. So he's moved to Jerusalem, and he's built himself a house. He's got a bit of a palace going on, and he decides that now that he is ruling and reigning in Jerusalem over God's people, he decides that it's time that God become the center of the life of his people. He erects a tent for the Ark of the Covenant that symbolized God's presence to be brought out of captivity and into a place of prominence in the life of Israel. So the Ark of the Covenant, you might be wondering, what is this Ark that David is so concerned about getting to Jerusalem? It was no small thing. The Ark of the Covenant was a box, basically 4 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet, that God had instructed his people to build. It symbolized the very presence of God. On the very top of it, there was an area called the mercy seat, where God told his people that he would meet with them and they would hear from him. And God commanded his people inside of this box to put 3 artifacts. He calls them testimonies. He told them to put in the stone tablets that he had given to Moses that contained the Ten Commandments. So that was in the Ark of the Covenant. Also, there was a jar filled with manna that God had provided for his people while they were wandering in the wilderness. That was in the Ark of the Covenant. And also, there was Aaron's staff that had budded when the people were questioning his leadership and authority. God did a miracle, and it was that same staff that God had used to deliver his people from slavery in Egypt. So these three things were in there, and the Ark of the Covenant not only was to symbolize God's presence, as I said, but it was also to serve as a reminder, giving God's people evidence of who their God was and how he had come through for them time and time again. It was to give them a historical focus to their worship. It was like God telling them, this is who I am. So David wants to bring God into Jerusalem to become the center of the life of God's people. So there's two attempts to do so in this passage. The first one that you read at the beginning was 30,000 men head out to Abinadab's house. It's about 50 miles from Jerusalem, where the ark has been for 20 to 30 years, to go and get it. It's a big procession. Now, I want you to picture the Canada Day parade in Abbotsford. Maybe you've sat in the sun and you've lined the street and you've seen the procession going by with the singing and the dancing and all of those kinds of things. I want you to picture that, only way more exuberant and for a 50-mile stretch. So they head out to get the ark from Abinadab's house, and they somehow get it onto a new cart, and the cart has oxen pulling it because they're trying to be efficient with getting the ark to Jerusalem so that they can worship God. So they put it on the cart and they start going. They're making headway. It says it's celebration and people are singing and they're dancing. They're playing all these kinds of instruments. It's a giant party. And all of a sudden it says when they get to a certain spot, the oxen stumbles and the ark starts to fall off of the cart that they had put it on. And Uzzah, one of Abinadab's sons, he reaches out to grab the ark or to steady it or maybe to keep it from falling on the ground. And it said that angered the Lord. Maybe that part arrested you a little bit when you read it because it seems a little bit strange. It said Uzzah touched the ark. He reached out to take hold of it and that angered the Lord and God struck him down right then and there. So you need to picture this celebration that's happening, this party that all of a sudden turns into sadness because Uzzah is laying there dead. And you might be wondering, well, why in the world did such a thing happen? That might strike you. God did that? They had good intentions. They were trying to bring the ark back. Why in the world would he have done that? And we don't know the full answer to that because ultimately God is God and we are not. And this might not fit your view of who God is, but this is God judging sin. We could say Uzzah should have known better than to reach out and touch that ark. Because in Numbers 4, God had told his people, do not touch the holy things, lest you die. And also, God had already been patient with them because they never should have put that ark onto a cart. Putting gods on a cart was something that the Phoenicians did, a nation that surrounded the Israelites. They put their gods on carts and they took them around, and here Israel had done that to their God. No, God had given them instructions in Exodus chapter 25 that the ark had these gold rings on it and they were supposed to put a pole of acacia wood through it and the priests were not to touch it. They were to carry the ark on their shoulders by the poles. They hadn't done that. So when Uzzah reached out to touch the ark, God killed him for his sin. It says that he did it for his error, but it was for his sin. And it was almost like God was telling his people there, yeah, you want to bring me in? Let me remind you who I am. I'm not safe. Don't get too comfortable around me. I am holy. You need to treat me as holy, as set apart. Now, after God killed Uzzah, David had a bunch of questions, and it says that David got angry that the Lord had struck Uzzah. And it says that David became afraid because he's like, how are we ever going to get the ark, to Israel. How are we ever going to worship God in Jerusalem? If he does this, he's not safe. How are we going to get him there? And he's afraid, so he abandons that first attempt, and he leaves the ark at the home of Obed-Edom the Gittite, and they left the ark there for 3 months. I think David was terrified. He's just like, I want nothing to do with this, so let's leave it there and we'll maybe come up with a different plan and see what happens. So, it's there for 3 months. Now let's pick up the story. I'll read 2 Samuel 6, verses 12 to 15. And this is the second attempt to bring the ark after the first one went terribly wrong. It says, and it was told King David, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him, because the ark of God. So David went and he brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. So he's rejoicing, even though the last time it was dangerous, now he's able to rejoice. Verse 13, and when those who bore the ark of the Lord had gone 6 steps, so they're carrying it this time, they went 6 steps, he sacrificed an ox and a fattened animal. And David danced before the Lord with all of his might. And David was wearing a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the horn. So this second attempt, they do things a little bit differently. They carry it. They follow God's rules. There's more rejoicing. There's singing. There's leaping. There's praising God. It tells us that David even dances before the Lord with all of his might in a linen ephod. There's lots of people that question, what does that mean? But the big picture there is David had taken off his kingly robes and was wearing a linen ephod, which is usually what priests wore. And he's dancing in the streets because he's so excited that God was to be worshipped. With abandonment, he is responding to the living God through singing and dancing and leaping. So once they got the ark to the tent that David had erected in the middle of Jerusalem, he made offerings before the Lord there. And he blessed his people. And it was like the start of a new day, like a renewal of a covenant, so to speak, a reminder to God's people of who their God was and a place permanently for them to worship him. This was an amazing new day, a moment to celebrate, and I think they were probably a little bit relieved once they got to that tent. Phew, it worked this time. Nobody died. I'm so excited about that. So it tells us that everybody was celebrating this day, except for one person. Except for Saul's daughter, it says, who was actually David's wife, but in this text it doesn't say David's wife, Michal. It says Saul's daughter, Michal. She was disgusted when she saw her husband dancing through the window of their house. She was disgusted and she despised him in her heart. She was ticked. And when he went home and he went to say, hey, babe, isn't this amazing? The ark is here. God's presence is here in Jerusalem. Let's celebrate. She tore a strip off him saying, you were only dancing. You made a spectacle of yourself, David. How dare you? You weren't really acting like a king, David, with all of your dancing and your leaping. How dare you? You were just showing off for everyone around you. And I love David's response to his wife here. He says, you're just mad that God made me king in place of your dad. God is here and I'm going to celebrate before him. I'm going to celebrate in his presence. I am less worried about your approval than I am about giving praise to my God. Your approval doesn't mean anything to me compared to praising my God. And from that day, Michal was barren. So there's the story in a nutshell. Two attempts to bring the ark of God, one that's successful, one that fails, and David explaining himself to his wife, who's really choked with him. So what can we say about this? The first thing that I want to say about this text, to apply it to us, is we need to consider the God that we worship. If this whole thing was about God and him reminding his people of who he was by putting these relics in the ark that they were to carry it around as a reminder, we need to consider who this God is that we worship when we gather publicly to worship and when we're worshiping God privately at home. It is important that we understand who the God that we worship is. So my first point is this, the God that we worship today is not in a box. The God that we worship isn't in a box. David danced and he celebrated, he danced with all of his might before the Lord that was in a box. And I got to say, how much more, if David can dance and worship and express himself to a God that's in a box, how much more should we who have more full revelation of Jesus Christ express our worship to him with abandon? We don't need the ark as the center of our lives today because we have Jesus who is to be the center of our lives. He's the fuller revelation of who God was, who God is. So if you think of the relics, the things that God had told them to put into the ark, they had the commandments revolve your life around this. Follow these laws, follow these rules God told his people. This is how I want you to live. Well, we have Jesus who didn't just tell us how to live. He showed us how to live. He lived perfectly in light of God's law. He fulfilled all of the law and the commandments. And not only did he do that to give us an example to follow, he sent his Spirit and he wrote his law on our hearts that we could live the way that he wanted us to live. Second thing, not the jar of manna that was in there. Not only did God provide for us food in the wilderness, telling us we can trust him because he'll give us what we need. Jesus has given us everything that we need in life and death, and he promises to continue to do that for us. Third thing, just like the staff was in there to remind Israel of their salvation, how God had saved them. We don't need the staff because we have Jesus who saved us, not just from slavery in Egypt, but he saved us from the power and the dominion of sin in our lives. He crushed the greatest enemy. He led his people to ultimate freedom. And lastly, in this story, Israel, what did they know of their God? They knew that he was dangerous because he killed Uzzah. He disrupted them. He was holy. He doesn't take sin lightly. Well, in Jesus, we know God still doesn't take sin lightly. But we don't have to live in fear that every time that we sin, whenever we mess up, we don't have to cower in fear around God, afraid that he's going to smite us when we do something wrong. Why? Because God already took that anger and that wrath that our sin deserves, and he poured it out on Jesus. He took that, so we don't need to live in fear anymore like they did, because we have Jesus, who is the perfect sacrifice, who atoned for our sins. So now you and I can come with confidence, enter with confidence the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace in the time of need, according to Hebrews chapter 4. So church, today let us turn our eyes towards Jesus. Remember the God that we worship, and remember that if David could dance before relics in a box, we can express our worship and our devotion to Jesus in just as exuberant of ways, even more so, I would argue. So a question for you today, wherever you are, is Jesus worthy of your worship? What kind of worship is he worthy of? How are you going to worship this Jesus today? Because one day every knee will bow and tongue confess, Jesus Christ is Lord, to the praise of his glorious grace. Worship Jesus. We don't worship God in a box. We worship a person. So then when Michael rebuked David for his dancing, we're getting to our second thing here. When Michael rebuked David for his dancing, I love David's answer. He just told her, it wasn't for you, it was for God. I wasn't worshiping in a crazy way for you, Michael. It was for God. It wasn't a spectacle. And from this we see when we worship, we need to have an audience of one. Our worship is just for one person. And this point, it has more to do with when we gather again for public worship, but it also has to do with private worship. We need to check our motives. If we're to have an audience of one, and we're going to remember that, we have to check our motives, because it's God who sees our hearts. He knows why we do what we do. And I'm talking specifically here about maybe singing, dancing, raising hands, however we usually express our worship in public. And the point is, we can be tempted when we are gathered to do certain things, not as much for God as we think, maybe more to be noticed by others. This is sin in our human hearts. We want to express ourselves to be seen by others. I remember when I was a teenager, I wasn't really following Jesus, but I had friends who were, and I remember going to these like youth rally worship nights and seeing all these kids who were on fire for Jesus with their hands raised and their eyes closed, and they're really giving her, they're expressing themselves in worship. And I remember seeing this girl that I thought was really pretty, and she was just like, oh yeah, worshiping Jesus. And I wasn't really feeling it, I didn't really get it. But I was like, oh, maybe I should do that too, because if she opens her eyes and she looks at me, maybe then she'll think that I love Jesus too, like she does, and maybe that'll impress her, and then she'll want to go out with me. Now, those were sinful motives, right? I never should have thought that, and maybe you felt that way to a different degree during a church service. You've looked around, you've seen people, and you want to join in, and you want to do what they do. Remember, have an audience of one. If you're going to express your worship physically, do it for God, not for the people around you. And the flip side of that is some of us are afraid when we're in public to express our worship in any way. We're stoics. And we stand like this. Why? Because we're afraid of what the people around us might think. We live in fear. We need to remember we ought to have an audience of one. If what Jesus has done for you, if who he is and what he's done captivates your heart, it ought to bubble out in praise and in joy. And I would ask, what kind of God are we showing the world if our praise is not joyful exuberance? If this is the only reaction that God does in our hearts, if it's the only way we express ourselves, which is crazy. And I know some of us too, we look at people dancing or doing whatever, and we might, something in our hearts might want to judge them and say, they're just crazy, they're just showing off, kind of like Michael. But I think from this audience of one idea reminds us, we don't look down on people who dance when they score a touchdown or who raise their hands at a concert. We don't think twice about that. Why would we judge people who are worshiping Jesus, responding to the living God in those kinds of ways? So when you worship, remember who the God is you worship. It's Jesus. And remember to have an audience of one. Don't do it for others. Don't live in fear of what they're thinking of you. And lastly, those last two flow directly out of the text. This last one is connected to the text, but it's more something that God's put on my heart this week as I've been reflecting on this. And I got to tell you up front, it might be a little bit harsh, but I think it's what God wants to say to us. Our worship must be more than just singing and dancing. Our worship of God has got to be more than just singing and dancing. It's got to go beyond just an experience or an event. I'd say you can have the best worship experience and God might not be pleased with it. You could gather thousands of people in a room and sing with all their might and dance and wave flags, and the presence of God could be palatable, and it might not please God. You could get the goosebumps or have just a beautiful experience of worship with Jesus, and it might not please him one little bit. Why would I say this? How can I say this? Well, because it's what God says through his prophets in the Old Testament, that worship must be more than just singing and dancing. If all it is that experience or that event, and it doesn't go beyond that, it doesn't mean anything to God. Let me read you a passage from Amos chapter 5, and it's through the prophets, Isaiah 1, Isaiah 58, Micah 6:8. God tells us what kind of worship he desires. But this one from Amos, it starts off describing all these different kinds of feasts and festivals that Israel did. You can put in worship, singing or dancing, whatever you want. Amos 5:21-24, God says to his people, including us today, I despise your feasts, and I take no delight in solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I won't accept them. And the peace offerings of your fattened animals, I won't look upon them. Take away from me the noise of your songs, to the melody of your harps, I will not listen. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Those are pretty strong words. God says, I hate your feasts. I take no delight. I wish you wouldn't do this. I'm not going to listen to you. Why? Because your worship is empty. It's missing something. It stays there. One commentator has said the missing ingredient in their worship was authenticity manifested in a lifestyle of obedience. Israel's rejection of justice and righteousness in the social order, so their worship wasn't affecting how they lived every day, made inevitable God's rejection of their worship activities. God didn't care about how loud they sang, how much their hands were up, the feeling that they got. None of those things mattered to God because they didn't live in light of it the rest of the week. They didn't care about justice and they didn't care about righteousness. They sang their hearts out. They danced. But God didn't accept it. So right now, when people around the globe are crying out for justice and for people to act in righteousness, are we seeking it too? Do we see the connection between our worship of God and how we live all week? Church, are we so concerned with when we can gather again to worship? And that's going to be a beautiful day, but are we so concerned about that that we've deafened our ears to their cries for justice? May that not be the case. I pray that is not the case. Lord, give us wisdom. Amen.